Eric, how's it going? Missed you.
I am doing great. I know it's been a while.
It has been a while, but I'm very excited to share that in the time since we've talked, I've baked 2 sourdough loaves that you recommended I look into. So thank you for that.
Hey, my pleasure, and good for you for taking the small steps. I think there were small steps to get there. Was it a challenge to get from where you were 2 weeks ago, knowing not much, to being a baker?
I think, well, one, it's always nice to have someone who is going to backstop, you know, with questions. I think that's a key one. Knowing someone who's been there before, who's been there, done that, that's nice. And although I haven't found the process to be really challenging, it is 4 steps and I have to do it overnight. Beyond that, it's really simple. And yeah. I've really enjoyed, you know, I read all the things that could go wrong, and I'm really happy that my first 2 loaves, none of those things have gone wrong, and they've been a hit.
You must be very good at reading comprehension, because if you wing it, you know, things can go wrong. So if you read the instructions, it's pretty much true. Like I've said to so many people before, you don't need to go to college to bake a nice loaf of bread. People have been doing it for 7,000 years, 10,000 years, something like that. And, you know, you too can do it.
It is
they
nice.
Didn't have books back then.
Right. Exactly. And it's nice to think that, like, my bread starter that we called, as you know, it's custom to name your bread starter. So we called ours Bread Sheeran, my youngest son.
Excellent.
Which was fun. And it's nice to think of the mystery to say, you know what, this fungus might be from ancient Egypt.
Could be.
Ooh, could be. Right. Could be.
Could be.
Eating the bread that Moses may have eaten, right?
Yeah. We're doing it the same way. I mean, it's the same process as people have done it forever.
Yeah.
Cool.
Really cool. Glad
you, and you like it? It tastes good?
It tastes excellent. I will say that, you know, there is one that had green olives and rosemary. Mm-hmm. And then I intentionally left the bread starter a little hungry. I didn't feed it the day before, which supposedly makes it a little more bitter. Yeah. And then I have it with local honey on top. And that was the little salty sweet combination, or kind of the bitter sweet. It was like dessert. It was amazing. With, if you can imagine, right? Olives, rosemary, a little bitter sourdough with honey. Very unique taste.
Cool. That sounds delicious. My mouth is watering. That's great.
Right. So listeners, I appreciate you may not have been hungry before you started listening to this, but we're happy that you now want to indulge in some great bread, and you too can learn. I'll link to the recipe that I used, which really works with a normal schedule, in the show notes, just so people want to give it a try and let us know, right? Hit us up on Twitter. Let us know, send some pictures of the loaves that you make.
Yeah. This is still trails and trials, right? This isn't something a bread podcast.
Yeah. This is not a bread podcast. I know, but I love, I love the tangent. So.
Cool. That's awesome. It's got to have something to do besides work.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, you can, now we find out you can make pictures on top. So if you make one with, one of the Dreamforce characters or Einstein, or that would be extra bonus.
Yeah. Pick your own logo. Yeah. That can be your friend or your kid's carving exercise. For the
right.
Weekend.
So anything new in your world over the last couple of weeks?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's been a couple of weeks. There was, some 3-day weekend. My kid loves jumping around the trampoline, and she broke her arm, but she's doing good. Work. Things are good. I've just had some good projects to get into and learn some new stuff. And I guess I'm happiest when I'm learning.
Yes. So,
things are good.
Very good. Well, let's get started then with our first segment here, which is, you know, what we learned lately. So it looks like you have a little bit of the metadata dependency API. Tell us more about that. What is that?
Yeah. Well, so you and I have talked about it, and we have talked a lot in the past about how important source code control is, and how great it can be to have an instance of Salesforce where all your custom code is in packages and nicely checked away in the code. And one of the difficulties with using packages is, well, this package uses the account object in its custom fields. This package uses the account object in its custom fields. So what am I supposed to do? Where do I put the account object in one of the packages, in the other, in the third one? And so we've had, you and I have had a bunch of side discussions on this, and there's some documents and things that I've seen our services team put together on packaging and best practices. And this really applies to people who are doing mostly programming and even multi, you know, person programming teams who are working on different projects that overlap. So the services team wants access to the contact object, and so does the sales team. And now what do? Because we can't say it's in the services package or the sales package because they both need it. One of the things we talked about that would help would be the metadata dependency API. And this is an API that Salesforce it's in beta right now, and I haven't checked it out. And so I wanted to dig into it before we talked about it here. And it looks like basically it's an API that basically you can put in any object, any field, any piece of code, whatever, and it will spit out the list of things in Salesforce that are dependencies or that have a dependency on this item.
Yeah, it's like a more robust version of that "where is this used" button when you go into a field in the setup UI.
Yeah, totally. This is a general metadata across the app, a tool. That's the good news. It's in beta. So if you are the kind of programmer who wants to roll this into your deployment code or things like that, it's there for you to use. The room for improvement, because it's beta, is right now you really only can query and filter by ID. So, you know, I can see a list of IDs that come back and it says like this, the account object of ID this is available, but you can't filter by name. So you can't say, give me all the dependencies of this class where the class name equals X. You have to go query the class ID first, and then feed that into a subsequent query. Or, so anyways, that was one thing I learned. It's good it's out there, and it's good that we're going that way. Mm-hmm. To me, my customers are always coming to you saying, how do I package my work? Mm-hmm. I don't use packages today. I want to do source code control. I want to do change CI/CD, continuous integration, continuous development. How do I start? Where do I start? And this was just a little corner of that world that I hadn't checked out. So that's what that was.
Cool. Wow. So the potential is significant there. And it's you can see where Salesforce uses this, like when you do a deployment validation.
We've talked about that. Yeah.
That, right. Behind the scenes, yeah. Really neat that they're exposing that to us. So if we want to see, what about this one field? What's this related to? Because that is a common question you get. When thinking about, hey, what if I was going to change the API name on this? What would change or break or be impacted, right? Because not all those things are, you don't get stopped by everything.
Yeah, right? We talked about this probably in like episode two or three or whatever, about how, we'll talk about it today, just one small thing, you change this field. Yep. Anyways, for everybody on the line here who's listening, it's something that it's great that it's out there. And I think we'll see it used more and more, either in Salesforce, tools like the Microsoft Visual Studio Code IDE for Salesforce for customizing Apex, or other IDEs. I think that's probably where you're going to see, or also DevCenter, which is a new beta product from Salesforce that helps point and click admins coexist with developer admins, and they can together work on using packages and things like that to move code all the way to production across all the sandboxes. I think you're going to see those tools use it, and the people who build those tools are going to be expert in this metadata API. Right. I think we're not going to, as normal humans, we don't have to deal with
that. Yeah, that's the Kapato and Gearset kind of partners of the world. Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think they're going to use it more. So now, that was one thing that I like. Go ahead.
Please, no, you're going to go into the next one, which I want to make sure you don't forget.
Yeah, so I also had the chance to, I've got a customer, it's been a customer for 7 years, and their CSM said, hey, they need to understand why they should be using Flow for their point and click logic. Because today they've got a mix of workflow, which is a flavor of logic from 8, 9, 10 years ago in Salesforce. And then Salesforce invented something better, which is called Process Builder. So they started using that, and it is better. But now there's Flow, and performance wise, it's even better, and capability wise, it's even better. And so I was asked, like, hey, can you show why it matters? Why is it worth, we've talked again, you and me before, about how important it is to keep your, whether it's your garden weeded or you keep your bedroom clean, You need to keep your Salesforce instance clean over time. You need to always attack your technical debt a little bit every year. 10% of your time maybe should be spent on
traction. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to do that. Because otherwise, just stuff piles up, just like in your yard, just like in your room, your technical debt or laundry debt, whatever kind of debt you want to call it, it's going to build up. So I had to do a bunch of research and find out, you know, what are the differences in flow and how is it new? And I learned a bunch of things. And the big takeaways are flow executes faster than process builder. Flow can avoid certain problems around recurrency. So whenever you change a record and it fires a workflow after that, when that workflow updates itself again, maybe through a field update, the triggers fire again one more time. So there can be a double execution of a trigger on an object where there's also a workflow. And that, I'm sure for everybody, that sounds a little bit messy. It shouldn't be that way. The reason it's such a problem is because every time you're operating on a record, Salesforce locks it. And it locks its parent also. So if you have a master detail between, you know, contacts and accounts, and you update the contact with a workflow upfield update, while that update's firing, it also updates, locks the parent account record. And while it's locked, that account record can't be updated. And in my customer's case, they're doing a bunch of batch updates of accounts, contacts, and opportunities or orders, something like that all the time. And they were experiencing row locks. Probably one of the reasons is because they had 2 to 4 workflows on the account, things using workflows for like account executive reassignment or on cases too, case routing. And so nobody was doing the work of figuring out there's an existing workflow on this object. I really should fit my logic into this workflow or into this process builder, but Salesforce is so easy to customize. I'm just going to create a new one. Have you seen that before?
All the time, especially because people have hundreds. You could have 100 workflow rules per object.
Okay.
So if you didn't have any kind of syntax or nomenclature, you're like, I'm not going to look through all of these. I'm just going to go do a new one. And even with Process Builder, building a process, it was designed to consolidate, where now I could have diamond steps and I could have multiple potential outcomes within a single process, you know, but it's just people use the same. It was so close to workflow. They just use the same aspect of like, oh, I'll just create a new one, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, the big announcement this week was that Salesforce officially announced the retirement of Process Builder and workflow will be coming in winter 23. And so it's a great time to talk through, and there will be migration tools introduced in 22. However, going back to your technical debt, businesses evolve. And so that business logic, some of that is probably significantly out of date. And it's a great opportunity to say, look, we have over a year, let's start separating it out month by month and really evaluating the logic and start thinking about, let's not just automatically migrate these things. Let's consolidate them, reduce the ones that are deactivated, remove them, use it as an opportunity to kind of clean out that closet and get it back to a position that's very useful.
Yes. So I'm going to short circuit a couple of conversations you and I had. One of the things you have to do if you're going to take care of this technical debt is document your current state and what is there. And you need someone to know what are all the logic things that happen to the account. What are all the logic things, workflow, process builder, flow, triggers,
formula?
What are all the things that happen on cases, on opportunities? And you need to write it down in order of execution and make a note of what the dependencies are so that when you come back to it a year from now and you've forgotten it, you still know what it is. And then from there, really the right thing to do is if you're about to make a bunch of migration changes, you probably should have a programmer write some script automation, some regression testing for you so that you can test current state, go change your workflows, and then test against current state again and make sure all of your new workflow, now that it's in flow maybe, has the same outcomes as the original code does. I think that's a big reason people don't want to do debt reduction.
Yes.
And but there's kind of, unless you have a simple org, once you're an enterprise, you got to do it. And you said there's two tools that you can use. Yeah, do you remember what the names were?
And SMB. I mean, you can, you know, Salesforce allows you to really kind of box above your weight class. So
yeah.
It's there's very few orgs, in my opinion, that don't need this. So yeah, I mean, the elements that I recommend are Kapato robotic testing, there's Kapato automated testing, and then there's also Provar automated testing.
That's the name.
So I think Kapato is robotic testing. That's what they call it, and then Provar is essentially it's a Selenium implementation put inside of the Eclipse IDE. So you can simply press record and you go and do everything on your browser inside Firefox. It's really easy. And then you press stop and it basically does all that stuff for you in the future. It is magical. So I think it's the future. Absolutely. And it can check systems outside of Salesforce. So if someone sends an email, it can check for the email over there. If there's a web service that gets called, it can check to make sure that was done. Very, very sophisticated and robust. So I think it's cool. I think it's definitely an important thing. And going back to your point about what I learned lately was really around that documentation piece. You know, I had a project. I've heard about this company for a long time. It's called Elements Cloud, and it's at elements.cloud. And we've recently brought them kind of into our suite of tools. Really, it's a software program that is focused on the discovery part of the project, right? So the discovery documentation, maybe a little bit of planning, because you can kind of evaluate, right, based on what's here, as you talk about, like knowing the reality on the ground and documenting your current instance is really important before you initiate any substantial change. So Elements Cloud essentially leverages the metadata, pulls it into an interface where now it'll show you like, okay, great. Much like the dependency API, I can go to a field and I can see all of the items that are related to that, including things that might even be passive if I delete it, such as reports, report types, and things like that. Okay. It won't block me from deleting my or changing my field, but I can visualize now and see all the places that is located. And I have the ability to kind of mark it up. So if I'm collaborating, you and I are thinking about what should we do, this, that, or the other, we can put notes on various items. Hey, maybe this can be removed. This can be changed. Maybe this could be combined with that. We're not actually doing the work yet. So we're not like in Jira or ClickUp or something where we're actually executing the story. We are planning, discovering, evaluating together. And so it's a software platform that helps us get the information in front of us and then start to mark it up, evaluate it, and kind of have it for meetings and to capture our assessments. So that afterwards, there's certain exports you can do that kind of give you like, all right, here's our recommendation, right? Maybe we've consolidated some things, made notes, we've added a few additional things that aren't here yet, but conceptually we've described them and this is what it would be like if they're here. And I've just been fascinated by it. And I love the impact of, or the focus on discovery as a strategic advantage, because as a consultant, if I'm not asking the right questions and exposing myself to the right information inside that org, it's going to be very difficult for me to actually have something that really doesn't just mean well, but does well, that actually satisfies all the competing priorities inside that org, all the legacy tie-ins, the integrations, the security frameworks, the different, you know, form factors that are being used, and all of that, you know, sometimes even the technical debt that's there that we just can't eliminate right now, it still has to be contemplated. And I have to continue to have it in my horizon. So I really like the tool because it brings a lot of that stuff up front, where it was a lot of manual work to go into lots of little areas, reviewing source code, all of that inside an org. It makes it a lot faster and puts it in a format that we can now bring in executives, stakeholders, clients, and have a really nice interface to look at that's really clear and intelligible by them.
Wow, that's cool. Is there a trial?
There is a trial. And for those who are consultants, they have a consultants program that basically allows you to spin up a new iteration for every customer for your work with that customer. Mm-hmm. And then the customer can choose to keep it or not. So it's really nice because it's they don't have to buy it, but you can spin up an instance for them. You use it for your project. And then if they want to keep it, they then subscribe and everything you've done up to that date all the notes, all the planning, all of that just becomes their artifact, which is really good.
Cool. I think it's really cool. Yeah. Like a distribution strategy or trial strategy.
It is. Yeah. And on a sidebar, Miro, who we've talked about before, has the same strategy as well. So they have a version. Very smart.
Great whiteboarding tool. We use them at Salesforce. I think we use them. I'm pretty sure we use them. We use a bunch. But that one has been, I think, the one that...
Oh, I love it. It's my favorite, big time.
It's super capable. It's maybe more than most people need, but it's not much. I mean, there are other tools that are simpler, and then I run out. Like, I do need different fonts. I need different colors. I need boxes around my charts. I actually find it to be
the simplest. Yeah, I think all the others that I've used are super complicated, and I find Miro single canvas, one place, you know, simple set of tools, keyboard, a few keyboard shortcuts. So
yeah, easy. And the amazing thing, if we didn't mention it, is this is whiteboarding with people from other companies. So you can get on a call together, whiteboard together,
yes.
And they don't need an account. They just log in. They don't even have to get a login. They just register, join the meeting. It's like joining WebEx. And they can participate and draw on the screen with you. And it's just a great interactive whiteboarding, virtual whiteboarding experience.
Yep. Very good. Let's talk about just one small thing. And you highlighted this, or at least mentioned it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about what happens when we do something simple. I don't know, like change a pick list value, right? A pick list is a series of values. And it's very easy to go into setup and just change. Oh, I can just change blue to red. And now people can go and they can select red. I mean, what is that going to do, right?
What could go wrong? I know. The thing, so the obvious one is, well, what if you change blue to red and every record that had chosen blue before is now red?
Yes, that's a big
deal. One.
That's one.
That's obvious. The one that comes to mind is if you're, so pick list values, if you delete a pick list value, I think one of the options is to inactivate it. But still leave it in all the records where it was chosen. So you're not screwing up old data that way.
Yes.
But you no longer want to make that choice available to your users.
That's correct. So new records can't save that value, but old records maintain that value.
Right. And I would say in general, that's probably best practice. Is that best practice or is that just the way it is?
I think that's best practice as well. Unless you know, because the option you'll get if you go and you delete a value, right? So really it's, you want to deactivate the value unless you know that all historical data also needs a new value. So then you would create a new value first, then delete the value and replace it with the new one that you added. Other than that, I agree. I think deactivating the value is better.
Yeah. And there is a wizard that will help you with the replacing, and it's not that painful.
Correct. And when you delete it, it'll ask you, right? Like, Do you want to leave a blank in prior records?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I suppose there are some times, right? There might be a contractual agreement or something where you can no longer select that funding source on any record, past or future. So you have to delete it and remove it from all the records.
Right.
That makes your job easier. But it definitely should be handled with care.
I got one more, be aware if you're going to do something like this, but what are your thoughts on this one? Is there any customer stories kind of mine that are favorites where you're like, oh my gosh.
This is one area. So we were just talking about the metadata dependency index or kind of API. Mm-hmm. And then we talked, I think in episode 2 or 3 about the shadow index, which is, you know, if I go to delete a field and it's used in an Apex class, it's going to stop me. And it's going to say, hey, you can't delete this field unless you remove it from these locations. This is an area where there is no shadow index. There's no protection. So any formula, pick lists are commonly used to normalize data. So therefore they're trustworthy to use in business logic and evaluation scenarios. So everything from approval processes to formula fields that are inside all those automations, flows, workflows,
validation rules,
processes, validation rules, exactly. And not only in the system, but outside the system. So you might have external integrations that are coming in, they're querying Salesforce, seeing, are there any records available for me here? If so, I'll take them. Those are often also using these pick list values as part of their filter criteria to know what records I should be evaluating to either update or export or whatever it might be. So changing a pick list value from red to blue can have significant impacts on automation and other kind of business logic evaluations. And it's totally passive. You can change the value of the pick list. It will not stop you. Nobody knows. All of a sudden, everything just stops working.
And there's no undo.
There's no undo. Absolutely. All you have is you have the audit trail that says you changed red to blue at this particular time. But people don't generally look at that often unless there's a problem. And sometimes these problems, imagine if you do it over a weekend and this was supposed to happen every 4 hours. And then you come in on a Monday and people are like, strange, like we don't have the deposits in the bank like we normally do. And it doesn't seem like we have the work orders like we normally do. And now it's just hair on fire, right? Nobody likes that. So being very deliberate about changing those values and socializing them is really important.
Sorry, one of the thoughts that comes to mind also, I said there's no undo, that because you can do a replace so easily across all previous records, it's almost the same as deleting a field sometimes, and when there's no undo. So this is one of the times that you just, you want to make sure you remember that there's a thing called the weekly data export somewhere deep in the setup menu. Why it's called the weekly data export, I don't know. It goes back a long time ago. It was never automated. But basically, it's your click button data export. Before you do anything on a pick list, just do an export.
Yes, I totally agree.
Grab that, zip it, download it, because just clicking on weekly data export does not give you the data.
Yep.
You need to actually get the email for weekly data export, click on the link, download it. Now you're safe.
Yeah. Well, and there's a plug too for, you know, like you can back up. All kinds of good tools for that. You know, Gearset has a great tool to help with that. And I will say that there is a comment I remember seeing from time to time. The goal was to change a pick list value, right? Mm-hmm. To basically like go from one to another. And the sequence logically seems like, okay, I go remove the one and I add the other. And I've seen people do that, right? That they'll go in, they'll remove one, thinking that, oh yeah, when I add the next one, it'll just like, I'll replace it. But it doesn't work that way, right? If you remove it first without having the next value present, it'll introduce blank values. And then you will not be able to insert that new value without a data load. And even then it's data surgery, because you're like, well, which records needed to be updated? So you want to definitely follow the proper sequence. And that is just having the due diligence, making sure you socialized it well. And it is really one small thing that can have very significant differences. And one thing I'll highlight as well is record types was something that was very popular in Salesforce, but is somewhat waning in its usefulness now that we have dynamic forms. It's still useful in this one particular area, which is I have a pick list. It has 20 values, but I only want 5 of those values to be visible on this record, and then another 6 values to be visible on this other record. That's that's its primary function at this point, in my understanding. And so one of the challenges with it, when you introduce a new pick list value, is that you can add it to the standard pick list, what we would call like the master list. But if you don't independently add it to each of the record types, it's still not visible to everybody who uses those record types. And that's a pretty common thing I still see with admins sometimes. They get requests, they say, oh, I added the pick list, and then nobody can see it because they forgot to go in and add it to each of the individual record types that it should be participating in. And so one consideration around even adding a new one is that can create some confusion and unexpected behavior if that those additional steps aren't followed.
Yeah, once you learn it, it's not a big deal once you know how to do it. But that first time, so we're just trying to let people know there can be a really bad first time if you don't do it right.
And I can't wait to, I haven't seen it on the roadmap, but I believe there is an idea to add this functionality to dynamic forms based on filters. And so I would imagine that's coming soon so that record types can be retired.
That'd be cool.
I agree. All right. Well, let's transition now to what we are excited about.
How about you talk about what you learned?
I'm going to start with, just a feature that I learned based on a, this was really just putting together a project or a solution design for a potential project in the field service space related to, you know, you think about storms come through and they like damage everybody's cars. And so this company repairs those cars. And so sometimes they have, you know, they're going to bring through 10,000 people in a given day at like a rented high school football stadium or parking lot. And so they need a quick way to kind of broadcast out within a particular area and have people come in and basically find all their own scheduling spots and everything really quick so they can triage everybody up and get through 10,000 people in a weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty cool. And this is typically something I would think of, you know, there's a custom development, maybe there's Calendly or something. So it's really cool to see that Salesforce has been working on this. And I've seen other areas where they've taken the field service kind of technology around booking into like the dispatching, and they've kind of pulled it out. Remember the work.com solution came out of this and created this really cool thing for registering workspaces. And so similar here, from what I've heard, you have lightning scheduling, and there's kind of both an inbound and an outbound component. And so the one we were focused on was the inbound component, which is essentially kind of a self-serve scheduling model. You kind of notify people that, hey, please come and schedule. And so then Salesforce provides an interface based on criteria. You know, we set the parameters in Salesforce. When can it be scheduled and with who and at what location, all of that. And then people just stream in and they choose their spots and sign up, and it creates all of the, you know, necessary kind of work order records. And so everybody just goes in there and sees, hey, here's my list for the day, assigned to various people. And it's a really cool solution. And for something on the build versus buy paradigm, I mean, you can license this for almost nothing and have this really robust solution for doing this this kind of scheduling, both in mass like this, as well as just kind of an ongoing basis. So it was a really cool feature. I love the field service side. So it was neat just to see that kind of, you know, consumer-based scheduling and just something that's native on Salesforce.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I think you can actually get scheduling not just with field service. I think you can get it with just as an add-on.
Oh, you can. I was just highlighting that the core components of it, I think, were derived just like some of these other solutions.
Yeah.
They took it out of field service and then made it into its own solution.
I could be wrong, and we'll talk about me being wrong in the next section, but I think you can use it in multiple scenarios. I remember working when I was in the healthcare team, and we would be providing solutions to doctors who want to get off their old school office management systems and use Salesforce to track their patients and do scheduling. And Lightning Scheduler had just come out. This was around 2015. So that was 5 or 6 years ago, and it's gotten just better since then. And so, it's really cool. It's really, and this is one of those things also where you could reinvent the wheel. You could go write your own scheduling system.
Sure.
You could stand up a server and you could put some open source code on it. There's many scheduling options.
Yes.
There's a simplicity. It's kind of like, you know, buying Mac products or things that just work together. There's a simplicity in getting field service with Service Cloud, with chat, with whatever, all the different tools you might need to run your call center.
Yeah.
If you have dispatch, you might need the field service as well. Like, they just work together. And some of my customers, they insist on using their own chat engine or their own AI engine, which this is fine. We can do call outs, but you should really consider using the things that come out of the box together, because it's way less programming.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And way less integration.
My understanding, I could be wrong here too, right? And I'll certainly participate in your next segment.
Yeah.
But I think there's the scheduling assistant, which is what was kind of the renamed one that was out a while ago. That was like, you know, the interactive one where you would send it out to somebody and they would choose a spot based on your calendar. And then this one, Lightning Scheduler, I for some reason, I think that this is a relatively new thing. And that's always been a fun thing in the Salesforce world, is to watch the marketing language and what things are called evolve. But maybe it's just new to me.
Well, there was also in Salesforce Inbox, which is an email client, there is a plugin for Gmail that lets you reuse templates that you've composed, but also you can insert time slots in your email to your customer saying, hey, I'm free in the following times. Which of these do you want to book for our meeting? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Oh, that's something different?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we got three.
So this is good. So we'll have it in the show notes. And this is a great example of all of us learning at the same time, right?
I know. We can tell you about integration, but like actually exactly like there's so many products in Salesforce. And unless we implemented them recently, we got to go back and check.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just knowing nobody knows everything. And that's why
it's true.
It's just so good to have, avenues of learning like this show. So talk to me about what you're excited about.
What I'm excited about is in doing my research for this migration to flow presentation that I did mm-hmm. and what the value is, the customer success director who is working with them on their row locking issues and why this is happening. And by the way, row locking is a database problem. It's not just a Salesforce problem. Most databases that I know of, if they're relational databases, have row locking issues. Modern architectures like Snowflake or
NoSQL,
there's no row locking there as far as I know, right?
That's my understanding. Yep.
Yeah. So tangent there. So row locking is a thing when you deal with databases. And so I'm working with the CS customer success director, and she shares a recorded meeting that she had internally with a group of super experts at Salesforce on performance. And these people are sitting around just like, you know, you and me are. Maybe there's three of them on the call, and then there's a guest. And the guest is the customer success director who says, I've got this problem. I'm a customer. How do we solve it? And I've been here at Salesforce for a long time, and I don't deal much with what happens after the customer buys it. I don't know implementation. You know implementation better than I do. But every once in a while, I do hear about, like, there's this weird performance issue. I'm getting a timeout on my data loader. Why is that happening? You know, because I keep relationship with my customers.
Sure.
I was so excited to hear and see. I watched this recording for like an hour. I saw three customer success directors come in, meet with this team of experts and say, this is what's happening. And they pulled up a Splunk report that shows the analysis of behavior of the customer's instance. There's no private data in this log data. We've already gone through years ago and taken out all private data, like what are the names of your data, opportunities, accounts, contacts. The names of your users are not in the logs. The names of your classes are not.
Yeah, there's no like identifiable information.
There's nothing. And it's a pain in the butt for us, but it's better for everybody if we don't know exactly what it is you're talking about. The good thing is, though, we can look at these logs and go, based on the profile right now of what's happening and how often these are running, I can tell, number one, that you haven't enabled or this customer hasn't enabled the critical update that was rolled out in the last release as a suggestion that would improve their flow performance or their process builder performance. Can't remember which is, we talked about this. It'll improve their flow performance by like 50% for before insert situations. That was one. And also flow, I think it was flow used to load some kind of context before it executed. And now that this critical update has been released, it's much quicker to execute. So anyway, they can look at the analytics and they can figure out what is probably a likely problem. They also see things like, well, how many times a day are row locking happening? How many times a day is, you know, on accounts or on contacts or on opportunities? And so they can see with a culprit object and they can see the issues happening with that object. And I just was in, it didn't take like somebody to, this is a polished process. And I was excited to see like, dude, this is awesome.
Yeah. Like you guys have worked on your own tooling inside. To be able to quickly kind of root cause and analyze and find out where the opportunities are. So this is cool. And really, right, isn't it any mid-market or enterprise client has or customer has access to this CSM team, I think, right?
You basically, I think, I don't know anymore. It used to be everybody. And I've been here, like I said, a long, long time. And as we've gotten more customers, it's been up the higher and higher ranks. It could be mid-market and above. I don't know exactly who it is these days who gets a CSM. Most companies don't need a CSM for anything like this for performance. It's really when you get to be big and you've got a bunch of integrations and you've got a bunch of developers on Salesforce, there needs to be somebody who's coordinating post-purchase of Salesforce. You need to talk to an expert right now. And we have something called accelerators, which is a day to 3 day or an hour to 3 day type engagements where you can talk with an expert in sandbox management strategy or whatever, migrating to Lightning, whatever it might be. So the CSDs, customer success directors, or CSMs, customer success managers, same type of person, just a seniority difference, I think. They're the ones that help with that. And I want to say again, like, well, it's super cool that my huge customer, you know, had this experience to get reviewed like this. Most customers probably don't need this, but we've got enough that are big enough where now we have standard dashboards to say, let's look at rule locking, let's look at org performance, let's look at integration performance, let's look at whatever for one org, and we can find out, you know, what's going on. Nice. So that's pretty cool.
Well, for anybody who does need that kind of, you know, feedback and strategy, right, they can always go to johnkline.com and reach out. They might find us and good feedback.
Excellent. Yeah. I mean, so that's pretty cool. I think it's something that we've been able to do for a while, but it took an expert in Splunk to query the data, group it, chart it, you know, limit it, filter it.
Yep.
And thankfully we've got some super smart people who now just made it easy. So I can go do it. Even if you don't know Splunk, you just find the org ID and you know, the pod it's on, and you can go find out, you know, what's healthy and unhealthy about this instance. And this is something we monitor on a macro scale. So we're looking at this all over the place. But if there's a particular issue, I was excited to see, like, wow, look at who we can go to. And I'm also glad it doesn't have to be me, because I used to get those questions.
It is fascinating, given just, you know, to take a little sidebar on architecture, given the fact that Salesforce is like, it's this massive single database that all the customers are kind of storing their data in and their metadata. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, right? Because essentially you're cohorting that performance data out of this massive amount of detail coming out of this common infrastructure, right?
Yeah, so everything is common within that pod. Yep. So I don't know how many customers are on a pod. And then there's, I don't know, 200 pods. I don't know how many there are. Mm. So I want to claim it is amazing it is to be one massive database, but it's a lot of data. And I think about stories from 5 years ago about people saying, maybe Mark Benioff said this, you know, it's the fourth industrial revolution.
Yes.
And the third industrial revolution was mobile. And the fourth was like AI or data or whatever. Data is overwhelming us. I mean, look at Salesforce looks at log data from everything that we do in order to serve our customers better. It's just, there's a whole new skill set needed now to go look at large sets of data, loading large sets of data, transferring petabytes of data. You don't just do that with a file drop.
No, you don't. No. Yeah. I mean, I heard a statistic. I don't know what the exact detail is, and we'll have it in the show notes, but essentially it was like, you know, there's been more data created in the last 5 years than all of human history prior.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is crazy. I mean, given, you know, I have this like really basic Garmin watch here, and it's still create. I mean, it's like keeping track of, you know, like all of my steps, like various degrees of heart rate, intensity. I mean, you know, that's this thing's going to create gigabytes of data.
Yeah.
You know, in a given
everything year. Is instrumented. Everything is instrumented. Everything. There's a new thing now. They talk about the ability to observability. When you build an app, it needs to be observable. Like, we need to know it's up or down. We need to know what it's doing. Yeah. It needs to communicate outward. And I've heard that term recently. It's probably not a new term, but it's an emphasis. Now, whenever we build a feature in Salesforce, observability is a huge part of it. Instrumentation for performance is a huge part of it.
Nice.
We need to be able to tell you what was the experience page load time for the native components or pages that we build. And that wasn't there, you know, before we had Lightning.
Sure. Wow.
Very cool. Anyways, I was excited about the performance experts.
So. Yeah. So now we're moving on to something, you know, something noteworthy that inspires us. And, you know, I think I'll start, and I probably have something that's a little bit unexpected in that, you know, I said something the other day to, you know, in my model, I work a lot with partners, and, you know, many different Salesforce partners hire us to actually do the work behind the scenes. And so part of my job is I want to inspire these partners to adopt certain, you know, best practices and certain kind of cultural values inside their own teams, because having those values and those best practices is going to help lead to a better product for Salesforce customers, even for those we don't work on. So I'm trying to kind of have that bleed out or kind of that residual value flow into their organizations so that even the things we don't work on, their team is still using the success factors that we use in their own projects. So one of those aspects is I told them, I said, you know, what I love about UAT, and UAT is user acceptance testing, is essentially a what it means is it's a basic testing plan that your customer can go through. Let's say a new feature was delivered or something, that they can actually walk through this process and validate not only is the process accurate according to how we do business and how we want to work this process in Salesforce, because there's a lot of flexibility there, and it actually had the expected outcome we were looking for. And I just said, you know what? What I love about UAT is it's freedom. And I'd never said that before. And I thought through, and it, to me, it was very inspiring. And I think that's what I want to share, is that most people think UAT is some people think it's boring, and other people think it is too time consuming, detailed, a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And my perspective is it's very inspiring to me to think about there's a stakeholder at the business who sometimes is putting their own job on the line for this project. You know, they've recommended CRM to the organization. They've recommended spending $50,000 to bring it around. Maybe the organization has never done anything of this capacity before. So their job is riding on the success. And certainly a certain number of sleepless nights is riding on the success of this, because we're not in the organization. If it doesn't work out well and we put it onto users without validating that, who's going to take the heat? Well, they are, because realistically, right? We're just in a contract. We can wipe our hands and be like, look, we did our best. That's on you. And we can walk away. And so to me, UAT brings freedom because one, it frees up the consultant or the Salesforce partner to really validate, is this, you told us you wanted something and this is what we have. And ideally this process starts way early in the process. You're not waiting till the end, but this is what you told us, what we understood, and let's walk you through it. And does it follow the steps you think it should? And does it provide the outcome that you agree it should? And if it doesn't, then now we have a detailed list that we can work from to fix it and say, well, which step didn't work? 6, 7, 8. Guess what that does? It makes the customer feel smart. They never feel dumb in the process. They never feel like they are not able to fully enter in, to fully understand, comprehend, and provide feedback. Because what happens often here is if you don't provide that, let's say you just give a video or you just tell them how to do it. If they don't really know or they don't understand, what are they tempted to do? I trust you. I mean, I'm sure it'll work out fine. I mean, you know, you guys have been working with us and this is what you do and we're paying you and we trust you. Dangerous, right? Because the goals of those two different groups are very different. And the knowledge of the users inside the business and all the unique kind of competing priorities and tensions. So to me, it's freedom to be able to validate that and bring something that can prove that we delivered what you asked for and we exceeded your expectations. They can sleep well at night. They can go to their boss. And when their boss says, all right, we're going live next week, how's it looking? They can be like, two thumbs up. And that's not subjective. I've gone through UAT. I actually brought in two or three other people that were not involved with the project team, but the UAT process was so clear, I could just onboard them to it. And they went through it and it was successful. So we got a great pilot for our go live already. We got a couple champions, all because we were willing to be accountable. And this is the part that I think is the biggest resistance, is it makes the consultant or the admin accountable to their stakeholders. Because when you put it in front of them, they're going to be able to say, no, this isn't right. This is wrong. It's the wrong thing, wrong outcome. We got to be able to embrace that. It kind of goes back to what you were talking about before. Embrace that potential for it being wrong. You know, embrace that failure early and fix it while you still have time. And so I'm a big fan of UAT, and the UAT is freedom for us and hopefully for many.
Yeah, I think that the thing, what's going to happen within a UAT, with the initial design of the UAT, And then the actual execution of UAT is that there will be feedback. And whoever thought it would be perfect had bad expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you get it perfect the first time,
I don't think it's realistic. It's not realistic. Yeah, somebody's not telling you something.
Right. I mean, it's almost like your UAT, your customer should keep asking for more UAT in UAT design until, like, if they get it perfect the first time, like I want to see texture on my UAT. I want to know that I got something. I want to know that we caught something. UAT is important because whatever it is, it was going to bite you in the butt anyway. Like whatever you catch on UAT, you got to fix it and it's documented. You know what's wrong. If you hadn't done a thorough UAT, you can think you're free and think you released it, but now it's in production. And now everybody's expectations are that everything is fine. And now when it goes wrong, now the blast radius is much larger and you don't want that. So minimize your blast radius, test earlier, do your UAT earlier, find out what those issues are, and then it'll just minimize the size of your blast radius.
Yes, so agree. And somebody told me that in your brain, anxiety and enthusiasm come out of the same part of your brain. And so my encouragement here is that people have anxiety about UAT, about the process of putting it together, the being accountable to the customer, all of that. It can be a rigorous process, especially on a larger project. My encouragement is that imagine yourself putting this in front of the customer and having them be like, green light, green light, green light. And not only that, having them be so excited because they never recognized how much work you guys did until they went through the 82-step process that generates all the documents. And now your work has been made visible and valuable in a new way, and their expectations are exceeded. So turning that anxiety into enthusiasm is a great way to think about how to bring this into your organization. And I certainly, you know, for us, we do UAT starting with the first sprint. So as soon as we have anything to demo, we already work on our test plan and we get the client doing UAT within the first 2 weeks of the project. So it's just something they do ongoing. And at the end of it, we just bring all those test plans together and do an end-to-end process. Mm-hmm. It's very straightforward. And they're like, of course, we've been doing this for weeks. No big deal. And we've been making it visible and valuable. So it's a real encouragement that you can turn that anxiety into enthusiasm.
Yeah, absolutely. So along those lines of, you know, maybe how you learned that UAT was so important, something I heard recently is how important it is for each of us to have a failure resume. And our resumes are never our failures. Our resumes, if you go to my LinkedIn,
right, it says they're trying to be polished, right?
I know for the past whatever years, I released 16 projects in 9 years at whatever, it's still at Accenture when I was there or something like that. And that is kind of boring. And not every culture is the right culture to have a failure resume you discuss. But after I heard this, I think it was on a podcast. I think it was an executive, a woman who runs Sony Entertainment, I think. I forget who it was. She was saying how she really values, she thinks she'll ask somebody, what's on your failure resume? What are your top three? What mistakes did you make? And if you go back and look at your life, I mean, going back to like your fifth grade book report, you know, that you didn't do a very good job on, or maybe you offended somebody when you were 25, or, and this is a bit autobiographical, but it has to be.
We appreciate your vulnerability.
Yeah. Or, you know, whatever. The things I know best in my life, I'm passionate about today. And when I talk about this like this, it's because I've already seen it go wrong. And I maybe even did it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helps you grow to go through and say, what are my biggest failures? And what did I learn? And you've got to be able to talk about it with yourself. You don't have to tell everybody. But this will come up again in the future. You go to a job interview and they're going to say, so tell me about a time when you did something that didn't work out right.
Mm-hmm.
You will already have the answer to that question because you have put together your failure resume and you can say, well, one time, and I've talked about this in an earlier episode, I was doing development and my testing wasn't done and I went through UAT and my test scripts were still failing. And I thought that was okay because I didn't know how important UAT was.
Sure. And then you went into the demo, right?
And I went into the demo and then the client's going like, really? We're supposed to sign up on this and it still has bugs? Well, it generally works. It's just this one, you know. Anyways, that was my mistake. That was one of my mistakes. I didn't understand. I had a communication problem, whatever the issue was at the time. I now know, like I said, my takeaway from that is if your boss is not understanding you, it's your fault. That's how I try to do my best now to make sure people are understanding me. Because if I'm picking up that someone's not communicating, I'm not going to say it the same way. I'm going to have them explain it to me. I'll try some other way.
No,
anyways,
exactly
that comes
right from
me hearing my faults. And so like, think about just tonight on your way home, if you're driving, because you may be at work, but really maybe not. As you're walking down the hallway to the kitchen on your commute home from the office, which is in the family room, think about your three or two failures that you can learn from, or what, and they probably two come to mind probably really easily. Find five. And they're going to be in all kinds of different areas. And I think it just will make us all better storytellers.
Yes.
More relatable. Who's perfect? Those people are boring. I don't want to talk
to
them.
Totally. Yeah. No contours.
Talk to people.
No contours. Yes. Like all, they're all flat Stanley.
Yes. 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 Anyway, failure resume.
Yes. Well, so while we're on this, that's our last segment for this show. But as a point of demonstration, let's share one failure that in what we learned from it. So, and it doesn't have to be related to technology. So I'll start. So I went for a time and for over a few years, I started to learn how to cook a little bit. So I hired, you know, like I subscribed to HelloFresh and Sunbasket and some of these different services that provide me a recipe so I could cook for the kids. And one day I got a little confident and I was like, you know, I think I know enough now. I could probably step out and, you know, try and make my own dish without the, you know, nice visual presentation with photos and the guidance. So I thought, well, I really like Indian food. And one of my dishes I really like is called biryani, right?
Chicken biryani.
It's a rice dish.
Yeah.
And so I went to the local, you know, here in, I live in Chatsworth. There's lots of people from India here. I love it. So there's lots of good Indian food around. And so there's a little Indian sweet and spices store. And so I went in there and I bought, you know, like a little box of biryani mix. And, you know, I saw it had directions on the back. And so I got what I needed. And, you know, because a lot of those spices, like your average American kitchen doesn't have, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I should have looked while I was, one, I shouldn't have gone to a category like Indian food. For my first off the, you know, I should have done something like, you know, fried chicken or hamburgers.
Or whatever. So, shoot high.
Shoot high. You know me, right? I'm a you know, shoot high and justify kind of guy. So I get home, I'm going to make the dish. And I realize that, okay, all the directions, first of all, are in metric terms. Mm. So they're in like milliliters, grams, kilograms. Okay. I got a scale. I can deal with that. I got Alexa. She can help me with that. The second thing though, was a little more difficult is that all of the ingredients were in a range. So for the box, it said like, oh, okay, great. Chicken, 200 to 600 grams. Rice, you know, 50 to 200 grams. And I was like, okay, I suppose there's some discretion of what one could do. So I did my best guess. Now, so if you've ever made rice before, right? Like you can put, you know, let's say a couple teaspoons or half a cup of rice and that'll fill three or four bowls. Or you could do like two or three, four cups of rice and that'll fill like a shoebox.
Yes.
Right. And when you're making a dish that you're going to mix the chicken, the sauce and the rice, getting the ratios right is pretty important. So I did my best guess of like, oh, it didn't look like that much rice. And I got some chicken, some sauce, all that kind of stuff. And then I mixed it and I had like two shoeboxes full of rice.
And I've done that.
Yes. a little bit of chicken, and like, you know, the sauce was, you could smell the sauce, but you couldn't really see it in the sea of rice.
Yeah.
And I brought it to my table, you know, of, at, you know, with my family, my kids, and they were like,
hungry kids.
Yeah. Cause everybody's hungry. Exactly. High stakes. And they were like, well, good job, Dad, trying something new, you know? And, yeah, nobody ate it because it was just too much rice. So that was my failure for dinner that night. And, so I had to find a workaround, but you know, definitely should have paid attention to the range and the metrics and asked somebody in the store, okay, if I used 200 grams of rice, how much chicken should I really have? How much sauce? What should I do here?
Yes.
There's one failure. That's
a good one. I mean, I with one of those HelloFresh things, we subscribe also to, you know, whatever, Sunbasket or one of those dishes. I hate going to the grocery store. I hate the question, honey, what's for dinner? I don't know. I've been working since 8 o'clock this morning. It's 4:50. I haven't even thought about dinner. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should have stopped at 3 and I should have thought about, you know, do I need to go to the store? But I don't, because I've got a podcast to do at 3 o'clock and every day is different. Sure. And like, whatever. Excuses. But anyways, I'm a pretty good cook. I've been cooking. I took cooking classes when I was 25 in LA, 4 different weekends for a half a day. So 16 hours of cooking classes. It was a great foundation. I recommend to everybody, you'll never be afraid of the stove again. You'll still make mistakes, but you can just wing it, like walk into somebody else's kitchen and say, I'll make dinner tonight. Just open the fridge. You got an onion. You got some butter. We're good. We can almost do risotto. You got any wine? No wine? Beer? It's not the same thing, but we can figure it out, you know?
Sure.
And by the way, I would never make risotto with beer. That's a risotto. The Italian kind, the name I can't remember right now. But my point is, like, once you learn the basics of cooking, you can do it. Well, I forgot to read the whole instruction set before I did one of these boxes, and I just blew past one section. And so basically, as a 45-year-old, I'm like, oh, man, just like the 8th grade test, when you have to like read to the bottom before you start the test. It still matters to this day. Yes. Yeah, I went through it too fast. So those are simple, cheesy, if I can call yours cheesy, simple, cheesy examples of like, hey, it's a cooking mistake, but whatever. If it's a work mistake, a management mistake, we don't have to go into details, but I've said things that I probably didn't need to say at work, whether I was a manager or whether I was not a manager.
Sure.
I was on speakerphone one time, and I wish I wasn't on speakerphone one time. A funny one is I was on speakerphone coming out of the elevator, and I started singing U2's It's a Beautiful Day on a 50-person conference call where we're getting a briefing on the state of platform sales business or whatever. Yeah. And there's like, all. Anyways, it's 8:30 in the morning and it's all of North American sales team and I'm feeling good. And I was on mute, but then I came off mute to answer a question on the call. And then I kept walking down the hallway and I'm singing It's a Beautiful Day in my own way on the conference call. And they're like, Eric, you're not on mute. Okay. Thanks.
That's so awesome. Well, anyways, what a fitting way, because it is a beautiful day, Eric. And did you want to share that with the listeners at all?
Yeah, sure.
What you were singing?
Sure. No, I'm not going to roll it out with that. No.
Well, that's beautiful. And so, listeners, if you want some failure freedom and share with us a little bit of your failures, feel free to reach out. And we will have a phone number soon that will be posted up. I haven't put it up yet, but we will have it soon where you can share your failures and you can also share your questions. And Eric and I will bring those onto the show from time to time. And it'll be a way of interacting with you so we don't have to schedule it, but we can hear from you, as we certainly want to help respond to what you are doing and also laugh and cry with you as you put together your own failure resumes. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, we'll see you later.